It is Saturday, May 25th, 2013. I'm broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek News on Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. That means me and even Ben, who's also in the air with me. Hey, Ben, how's it going, man?
Hey, doing really well. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
You said I am broadcasting.
I was alone a few weeks ago. I changed the script and I'm using it.
Okay.
I am broadcasting, right. And so are you, sir.
I almost left just now. I almost
I'm
saw, okay,
very
fine.
Glad you didn't.
Fine.
You know, since we're talking about meta information regarding the show, let me just invite people. I have complaints every once in a while about the theme song we use, which, of course, is Through Being Cool by Boingo. Devo.
Boingo.
Yeah, I know. I like Boingo. I'd love a new theme. If you're sick of that theme and every week you hear it and you try to fast forward the podcast or something, or if you're on the radio and you're listening to it, if you don't like it, you know, hey, we'd love a theme song from you. In fact, if we had a theme song that we had a full rights to, we could say that the entire show is Creative Commons, share and share alike, which is what we do. But we can't do that.
But that's the only reason why.
Yeah.
But you know, we do. We do
have a collection
couple
of songs
here and
true
there. Yeah.
Yeah.
We used to cycle between them. But
you know,
I kind of want to start doing that again.
Okay, I'll start doing it.
I really
the reason
like
I
one
don't
of them
is a just like technical thing, right? We come in before the show. I'm always prepped to get in the show ready. And after the show, we do the podcast. And then we get out of the station. That's the only time I'm here.
Mm.
But I need to get the music in the cart system so that
it
then it's easy, because I don't have to plug in cables with my laptop every week. That's why. So if you and I wanted to get together sometime, Ben, here at the station, and load all these theme songs we have into the system, it'd be great. But if I got a theme song that I love from a listener and we're just like, we're ready to go, I just move that one in. That would be our default.
Hmm.
Should we move on with the show at hand?
Okay, let's move
on.
Okay,
good.
Whatever.
Let's do some space news, shall we?
Yeah, let's do, well, May 24th. May 24th was yesterday.
Yes.
And at moonrise, that would be about sunset in North America, or at least in California,
we had a
full moon and a lunar eclipse, in fact.
In fact, the only time lunar eclipses happen is during a full moon.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. Well, unless you're watching a video of a previous lunar eclipse, then it could be...
Really? Really, you want to do that?
God. Okay. Anyway, lunar eclipses are pretty cool. I, unfortunately, was not able to see this one. They don't happen all that often. This one was visible throughout all North, Central, South America and the western area of Africa. So a big portion of the Earth wasn't able to see it. Do you know why they happen?
What do you mean why they happen? Why the Earth gets in the way of the light from the sun?
Hey, you answered my question accidentally. Yeah, that's what a lunar eclipse is, right? You've got a solar eclipse where the moon gets in between the sun and the Earth and blocks the sun. And then you have a lunar eclipse where the Earth gets in the way between the moon and the sun. Do you know why it's red?
I would assume because the atmosphere around the Earth still spreads light, and that light happens to be reddish. That's why we have sunsets that are reddish.
Very good. Very good. Yes. So I mean, this is actually the same reason why the sky is blue, right? So the sky is blue because you get this roughly white light coming from the sun. And this white light is made, ultimately, if you break up the white light with a prism, you get all of the different colors of the rainbow, right? So you've got red light in there, you've got blue light in there, all of that stuff. And that's what makes a white light. So the white light comes in from the sun. If you look directly at the sun, don't look directly at the sun. But if you point a camera at the sun, it's fairly white, right? But if you look at the sky, it's blue, because what happens is the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere, deflects different colors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, deflects different colors more or less, depending on the frequency. So that means that blue light gets scattered a lot more than red light. And that's why you see blue light in the atmosphere.
So you can actually imagine that the light from the sun, the blue light from the sun, the short wave light, hits the nitrogen particles and refracts them. That's a refraction happening.
Yeah.
And so we see from a large...
Refracts.
Refracts.
Is it reflection?
Maybe it's... Oh, see... photon movement between particles is very different than we think. Remember we were talking earlier about, if you think you understand quantum physics, you're wrong.
Yeah, that's
so we won't get into that. Feynman. But let's just say it reflects or refracts. We won't even talk about how. But
yeah,
basically,
bounces,
the short wavelength bounces, and because it's bouncing off of our general atmosphere, that's why we get the blue sky. Why is the sky blue? That's blue.
Yeah.
But what
also
happens
is
that means that the sky, the light that goes through for a long time, all the lower frequencies get filtered out. Basically. And that's why you see a red sky when it's on the horizon. Mm-hmm.
It's because you're going through more atmosphere.
Right.
So like the way I like to imagine it in my head, taking away all the physics and stuff, but the way to imagine it is you've got these very lightweight, and this is completely a metaphor, right? But you've got these lightweight particles and these heavy particles. The heavier particles are the red ones. The lightweight ones are the blue ones, okay? And so if you throw a bunch of lightweight and heavyweight things through something, water or whatever, the lightweight ones will be affected more.
Right.
They'll be more likely to get deflected off of their path, whereas the heavier ones, the red ones, will just right through it. And so when you're looking at the sun or the area just around the sun during a sunset, you're looking through a lot more atmosphere. Whereas if you look straight up in the sky, you're looking through just the very thin veneer of atmosphere around the Earth. And so because there are more particles in the way, you end up seeing more red.
Right.
Because are the ones that are
blasting
through. You know
what I love about this? I said that we're doing space news now. And in our space news, you answered the age-old question, why is the sky blue? Congratulations, Ben. Thank you for being such a geek. I want to do some more space news. So lunar eclipse yesterday, cool. You missed it already.
Yeah.
News.
We really, you know, with geek speak, it's funny with space news. It's like if the listener had a time machine, then so much of this news would be so much cooler because they could just go back and look at it. But, you know, my problem is I don't look ahead. I don't say like, oh, there'll be a lunar eclipse in 3 days.
Let me tell you that this is something that's coming up. Well, first off, let's fly back in history. Do you remember Tang?
Tang, the
space drink. Now,
the orange drink
was marketed as the drink for the astronauts, completely a marketing ploy and everything. But NASA what's that? It's just a, I don't know.
It's a powder you put in water, right?
Yeah, and mix it up and get Tang. Right. Yeah. I remember the taste of it,
so
and I don't like
weird.
It.
Weird.
But anyway, the point is that space food seems to always be kind of compelling to us. Remember, ever had frozen ice cream or, you know,
freeze-dried strawberries, freeze-dried, everything is freeze-dried, expensive in the gift shop.
So NASA just threw a small grant that got a lot of headlines to Systems and Materials Research Consultancy, and they're an Austin company, and this is to make new space food, but specifically, and why we're covering on Geek Speak, is 3D printed space food. So the idea,
it's 3D printed, so it must be cool.
Exactly. Now the grant's like only $125,000, which means that's going to be basic traditional 3D printing. And I say basic traditional because there's nothing new here. It's macro scale level printing. So the examples they talk about in this article is like, well, we've already printed chocolate, so of course we can print a pizza. No. That's not true. I got so angry at it because the reason you can print chocolate is because chocolate, when you warm it up, is liquid. And then you just inject it through a printer head. And as it cools, you can get a 3D sculpture. Neat.
Yeah,
that's cool. And then that's happening all over the place. That's great. But making a pizza from dried materials, totally different situation. Because the reason why food has the consistency it has is molecular interaction.
Yeah.
And these 3D printers we're talking about is deposit something that's in liquid form, let the liquid stuff leave, chocolate cools down, or on most of these printing, evaporation happens, depending on the material that's the liquid leaves, and then you get a relative solid. But food doesn't work that way. Food is molecular chemistry. It's a chemical thing.
So boiling or baking, you've got
molecules
cooking.
Forming. You know, like if anyone's made bread and understand gluten and how that works, like that, there is complex proteins happening, complex molecules happening, and that's what gives food the yumminess that it is. If you're just going to have a pizza that's printed from traditional printers right now, 3D printers, it's kind of like taking a whole bunch of goopy stuff in toothpaste containers and squishing it out. You're just going to taste like paste.
I don't know about you. I actually this morning had some 3D printed eggs and toast. It was great.
Was it 3D printed from our planet? Like...
Well, I can't even.
You know what?
I can't.
Scrambled eggs, you could 3D print. That's a good one.
But not toast. You said bread, so I was thinking.
Oh, yeah, bread. Forget it. I don't eat bread. I don't care.
You don't eat bread. You've got this paleo diet thing. Wait, can I just have to say, because I'm a big chocolate geek, I really like chocolate and I really like desserts. Chocolate is not as simple as people make it out to be. If you melt chocolate and then it hardens again, you're not going to get a nice chocolate bar kind of texture. You'll get this disgusting kind of, it's like if you think about a more expensive chocolate bar versus a Hershey's bar, and you take them and you hold them and then you break them, right? What's going to happen? The more expensive one is going to have a nice break to it. But Hershey's is just going to
I think that's the way
tempering. It's the tempering.
Yeah, exactly. Tempering.
Yeah, so basically the chocolate can, quick and dirty explanation, chocolate can be, can form these different crystalline structures. I think there are 7 of them or something like that. And there are 2 or 3 of them that are really good. It's called tempering. And so what you do is you take a piece of already tempered chocolate and then you melt all the chocolate, but not too
melty.
Yeah, not too hot. And then you put a piece of already tempered melted tempered chocolate in, and it seeds it.
Ah,
it actually seeds the way the rest of the chocolate is going to harden. It's so cool. So, that's why Hershey's bars, which are really cheap, are kind of weird. And that's why if you have a chocolate bar and it melts and then rehardens, it does not taste the same. It's just totally different.
Okay, so we covered lunar eclipse.
3D printed chocolate. Blah.
Okay,
that's all I'm trying to
say. Thank you. Ben, let's do some more space news. What else is going on the moon?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Of the moon.
Yeah, so there was a lunar impact. There was a...
Oh, wait, this already happened too?
There was.
Did we know about the lunar impact before it happened?
I don't think we did. No. This is May 17th.
Okay.
What happened? A week ago.
Was it cool?
So basically, for the last 8 years, astronomers have been monitoring the moon because it's pretty close to us. It's pretty easy to monitor. So we've had telescopes pointed at the moon for a while. And we've been looking for meteoroids hitting the surface of the moon. Just to kind of, I don't know, there are a lot of things you can figure out. When two things collide in a fairly, at high velocities, you can tell a lot just by monitoring it.
It's interesting. A lot of the meteorites we have on this planet are actually from the moon because of impacts that happen on the moon, and then the ejectae lands on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty cool. They basically just saw the biggest explosion that they've monitored on the moon, of course, as I said, last 8 years. So it was March 17th. It was an object about the size of a small boulder. So actually, I have dimensions for you here. Now, I'll go into this in a second, but the weirdest thing about this video actually is the beginning they have in this like techie green
matrixy
font, and they've got the weight and the size of the speed and then the explosive power of this impact, and they use metric, non-metric.
Uh-oh.
And it just weirds me out. It makes me feel weird. So I took the liberty of converting things. So it was 40 kilograms. That's 88 pounds. It was just about a foot or a foot and a half across. That's 0.3 or 0.4 meters. And it impacted the moon at 90,000 kilometers per hour or 56,000 miles per hour. So basically small thing, not all that heavy, ultimately 88 pounds. That's, I mean, I'm skinny. That's way less than my weight,
right,
impacting the moon. But we saw it from Earth because it was going 56,000 miles an hour.
That'll do it.
So, and we actually have some video of this.
I would assume at that size, we wouldn't know about it beforehand. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, and we'll pretty have, cool. we'll talk.
Well,
I guess that's kind of a geek bit.
Yeah,
be up on geek.org in a little bit. But you mentioned metric. When I was in high school, I had a fantastic physics teacher, Preston Q. Boomer, and he tried to get everybody in the class to really get that using metric system is so much easier. And the only reason people think it's not easier is because we have all our comparison sizes in a different system. So everybody knows how, in the United States, everybody knows how tall a 6-foot person is, right? They just have an idea of how tall that is.
But if you say, he was 2 meters tall, people are like, what's
but
the conversion?
If you start understanding what a meter actually is, and I've done this in my life, I know that, a 2-meter person is a little bit taller than 6 feet, right? Like, so you start to understand how big a meter is. That's a stride. A human stride is about a meter.
Well, what about a centimeter?
Well, it's the same. I kind of know it is. But the thing is,
it's just really divide about, by 10
it's really
or 100
about all of us using that system over a period of time. And then you're comfortable with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, of course, when you talk about space objects and you talk about speeds at, what do you say, 58,000 miles per hour?
56,000 miles per
that
hour.
That doesn't matter. That has no relevance to our... We don't know how fast that is.
Well, okay, the biggest problem is just what you grow up with, right?
That's true.
It's the intuition that you were talking about.
Absolutely.
Right? So if you have an intuition, that's great. Do you want to talk more about this after... a break?
Well, you wanted to mention the White House about this issue?
Oh, yeah, okay. So some people put up a petition on the White House's We the People site, and basically they just asked the administration to adopt the metric system as the standard system of measurement in the U.S. So the administration, the U.S., the White House issued what for a lot of people
was a
disappointing response. So I'm just going to read a portion of it. All right. They said, quote, "Contrary to what many people may think, the U.S. uses the metric system now to define all basic units in commerce and trade. At the same time, if the metric system and the U.S. customary system are languages of measurement, then the United States is truly a bilingual nation. Ultimately, the use of metric in this country is a choice, and we would encourage Americans to continue to make the best choice for themselves and for the purpose at hand, and to continue to learn how to move seamlessly between both systems." Okay, so that's basically what they said. The problem is nobody's going to learn how to move seamlessly between both systems, because that's mental work, right? And nobody's going to trade to change to the one that works best, because they already have one.
Of course, metric.
Yeah, metric works best, but everyone knows imperial. So why would anyone change? So kind of a bummer.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. And Ben, a geek bit, of course, is something you need to see. So we direct people to the website. And of course, the lunar eclipse video you were just talking about is up at geekspeak.org. But also...
Yeah, I've got another one. So there was a missile launch, and it created a weird expanding light bubble in the sky, as this article describes it on Slate. This is Bad Astronomy by Phil Plait. Highly, highly recommended.
One of your favorite sites. Yeah.
Any person who's interested in space, he writes for basically anybody. Here are the quick details on it. And then, of course, there are pictures that will be up at geekspeak.org after the show. But yeah, there was a bubble of light over Hawaii about 3:30 in the morning on Wednesday. And it was because the Minuteman III, which is a three-stage intercontinental ballistic missile, it launched. And the third stage of this three-stage rocket has ports on the side, and when the rocket gets to the right trajectory, it dumps all of the rest of the fuel, because it doesn't need the fuel, right? It has a little bit of extra. And so here's the explanation from Phil Plait of what he thinks was happening. Basically, he said, I think what's happening is the expanding shell is moving very rapidly compared to the thin air shell around it, because the missile is traveling so quickly. The shell rams the air, creating what's called shock excitation of the air molecules. Hitting them at high speed gives the electrons in the molecules extra energy, which they then release, causing the molecules to glow. So this is yet another example of interesting or weird-looking things up in the sky because of missile launches. Not UFOs, not paranormal, things that we do. And there was another one back in 2009 that I would also recommend people look up. It was a spiral in the sky, a moving spiral.
Let's put both those at geekspeak.org.
We
today.
Will. All right. And that was in Norway.
You're listening to GeekSpeak on KUSP. Also on KUSP is the 7th Avenue Project, Animals in the Wild and in Our Imaginations. New York Times contributing writer John Molam says our efforts to save endangered species depend in large part on the tales we tell about them. He talks with KUSP's Robert Pauly about his new book, The Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. The 7th Avenue Project, tomorrow, May 26th at noon on KUSP, or the podcast you can get to at kusp.org. Everything we talk about on GeekSpeak, of course, you can get to at geekspeak.org about an hour after the show. Everything's up, including the audio files and more links and stuff than you'd ever want to read about regarding today's show and every show since I found out, you know, we've been podcasting, recording, and doing all this since 2002 is when I started putting everything online. But the current system only goes back to 2006 because that's when the database integration happened. I never did the XML XSLT translation. So I got some more work to do to get the old shows up. But it could be a fun bonus at some point, extra 4 more years of GeekSpeak available online. All right, Ben, you had one more little space story, and that's about a small country.
I do. I want to take us out of this space segment with this sad story of a satellite being taken out. So basically, Ecuador only has one satellite in orbit. Only one. It's called Pegasus, and it's a nano satellite. It's very, very small.
Centimeters.
Do you want metric? Or
no,
what?
No. Go ahead.
Okay, so in imperial, it's 2.6 pounds. It's
not that small.
It's just hanging out up there. Well, it's very small.
Okay,
considering
how big. What's going on with it?
So it's been for the last couple of years just floating around up there in microgravity, taking pictures of the Earth and broadcasting the Ecuadorian national anthem
cool.
over and over and over again.
That's
so
sweet.
This is like all it does. It's like the most innocuous and innocent satellite ever. And it basically it got hit by a piece of a fuel tank from an old Soviet era rocket.
It is no more.
It's well, maybe it's still in orbit. They don't know what's up with it. It might be tumbling wildly. It might be
see the Soviet
something.
Union does it again.
Yeah, it's such a bummer. So the Joint Space Operations Center tracks more than 22,000 objects orbiting Earth. This is these are just the ones we know about, right? And 87% of the tracked objects are debris and inactive satellites.
Yeah.
So junk up there, and it's only getting worse, you know. And of course,
the film
also,
WALL-E starts out with going through that junk layer in a super future, and there's like tons of stuff. It's actually mostly open space, of course, open, but there's a lot of objects, and they're moving at relatively different speeds all over the place. So
it's
a mess. It's a bit of a mess.
It's a complete mess. Yeah. So anyway,
like
bad
in the
news.
New Star Trek movie.
What?
You seen it?
No, I haven't.
You haven't seen this new Star Trek?
No,
movie? What have you been in Bali
in,
or something?
I was in Bali. Yes,
oh,
indeed.
Okay.
I was in Bali.
Welcome back. Go see it. Then we'll talk about it, but off air because we don't want to do spoilers. All right. Now, on GeekSpeak, social software services section of GeekSpeak. I need Speaking Geek. There we go.
What?
Social software services section of Speaking Geek.
I don't understand what you're saying.
Tumblr. Tumblr, the actual, we use Tumblr for GeekSpeak's blog. Tumblr is an easy to software service that allows you to blog. So basically, Tumblogs, the idea of
Tumblogs?
The idea of microblogging, this idea that you just put up a picture or just put up something small, kind of like all the content on Facebook. Years ago, the first one I knew about really was Tumblr. And if you go to geekspeak.org and you click on our blog entry, that blog is actually hosted by Tumblr, even though it's part of our domain. And they, you know, Tumblr is a free blogging service that's become extremely popular. I use it for my personal site's blog at lyle.troxel.com, and I use it for GeekSpeak's blog, and it's integrated to GeekSpeak's blog pretty well, so it's the same domain.
It's just really easy, right? That's why it's so
easy.
Popular?
Yeah, it's just easy. They've got a good API for submitting stuff, so there's all these apps out there. I've got an app on my phone that allows me to publish. They also have a syncing service with other systems, so you can like do a scrape of an RSS feed and auto post, which doesn't work anymore, which is kind of a pain. That's why the blog's not always representing the shows, but it's just a one of those forms. Anyway, yeah. They were bought for $1 billion by Yahoo.
$1 billion. Wait, isn't all right. Tumblr free?
Yeah.
See, this is crazy. I mean,
there's a lot of customers.
If you were to talk to someone 15 years ago, pretty much anybody,
right.
And be like, oh yeah, a company that offers a completely free service would be bought by $1 billion. That's crazy.
They have paid features as well, including themes. So you can buy a theme and they make a revenue off that. You can actually create a new theme, an HTML theme, for somebody, then put it up on their store, and then money gets.
Oh,
so there's a bit of service going on there. And of course, Yahoo is probably going to monetize this a little bit more, but also maybe integrate it with Flickr, which is their photo service, which is also an awesome service, which I don't use very much, but I should. I even pay for it, so I should use that more.
Wow. Yahoo. So this is interesting. Yahoo. I mean,
well, it made sense because Yahoo's got too much. Yahoo needs to be cool and hip again.
Yeah.
And Tumblr is cool and
because
hip again.
If
Tumblr
about,
needs money. I mean, that's just all there is to it.
I guess I'm interested in seeing if Yahoo doesn't go down because...
Oh, yeah, it's not going down.
But I mean, in the same way that... Well, declining, at least. Like, I would be really interested to see if they can stop their decline, which eventually would be a demise, and turn it around. I mean... If you look at Yahoo just doesn't feel like the kind of company that can come back up. It feels like Yahoo the 90s, right? I mean, unfortunately,
when I was a child,
when I was just I don't know. That's just really intriguing to me.
All right, so what else is going on in the social services section of the internets?
We're talking about Twitter. All right, Twitter. So about a month ago, actually, I think almost exactly a month ago, I covered a story on GeekSpeak about the CBS Twitter accounts being compromised.
Yes,
I think
we
actually
talked a lot about
I covered two stories on that show.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen recently a lot of companies implementing what's called two-factor authentication. And we've talked a little bit about this before, but just a quick summary is basically instead of requiring for authentication or for logging in a password, which is something that the user knows. We all with two-factor authentication, you require a password, which is something that they know, and some kind of other verification like their mobile phone, which is something that they have, right? And so that distinguishes, that basically allows one user to be unique and makes it harder for people to get into their account, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, so Twitter did implement two-factor authentication quite a while ago, a month ago, I think. But it has a little bit of a problem. So basically the way the issue happens is if a hacker sends, let's say if I'm the hacker and you're the unsuspecting Twitter user, right?
Okay.
I send you an email. It says, hey, you need to change your Twitter password. And then I give you a link to Twitter's site, only it's not actually Twitter's site. It's a fake site that I set up that looks like Twitter, right? So you click on this link. It looks like Twitter. So you say, oh, it looks like Twitter. So you change your password, therefore giving me the password. Once you change that password, then I can use those login credentials and connect with the real Twitter. When I do that, it sends me a verification code. And then I enter that, and that gives... I use your captured login credentials to connect with Twitter. Twitter sends you a verification code. You enter the verification code on my fake Twitter account site, and then I can use that verification code to get into Twitter. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
Basically, I get myself between you and Twitter.
That's why you don't like email sending two-factor authentication.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
So two-factor authentication is supposed to get around this issue of me getting in between you and the site because it doesn't really...
Okay, okay. All right. So we have a whole show on two-factor authentication.
Yeah.
It's April 20th show, 420. And then of 2013, and then also the Twitter's hacked account stuff was the 27th show of April. Mm-hmm. I'll link that to today's show, which of course is the 25th of May.
Yeah, and of course I'll put this story
all
as well.
All the stories will be up there.
So.
But specifically, the reason you don't like the two-factor authentication that Twitter has implemented, which the two-factor authentication show, again, April 20th, if you're curious about that and how it works exactly, is that if I produce a fake Twitter account, a site, and say, please log in, and that might happen from anywhere because Twitter is being used a lot of times for authentication. You enter your information, then you're not really on the Twitter site. They collect your information. They submit a request to do the two-factor authentication to Twitter. You do get an email in the same amount of time. A text message. You take that text message number. You can't click on it because it's on your phone. So you take that digits they sent and put it into the web page. It's actually the bad guy's web page.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that's why it's a bad idea. Or that's a bad form.
It's something about the way that they've implemented it.
But the thing is, even if you had a app like Google, a two-factor authentication is an app running on your phone, you still have to put that number in. If you're in the wrong site, you're in the wrong site.
Yeah.
It's a crucial to do the wrong site. I would say this is more of a problem of the OAuth way people do things.
Uh-huh.
When you try to log in through another site and you click a button and it opens a small window, if you cannot see the location bar in the window, that is a problem. You don't know you're really at the real site.
Yeah.
And all of these sites do this, and I can't stand it. So what I always do is when I get that window, I close the window, I open up the real site, I make sure to log in with that browser, then I go back to that page, click the window, and since I'm already logged in on that correct site, it will correctly show the right page. This is too much detail and too hard to talk about, unfortunately.
The thing I hate about this is it becomes a little bit too complex to easily communicate.
It does.
So here's the takeaway.
The fast one.
The takeaway is if you get an email like saying, log into your Bank of America account, don't click on the link in the email because it might be fake. It might be a fake site. Always go, you should be the one who goes to the Bank of America or Wells Fargo or Facebook or Twitter, you know, whatever. You're the one who needs to initiate that. Same thing. I mean, the same thing goes for if you get a call from your bank and it says, hi, this is Bank of America. We need your details to confirm some recent transaction. If you give them the details, that could be someone pretending to be B of A.
That's true.
And so that's the reason you want to initiate. So that's really the takeaway.
More on social software services on GeekSpeak's section of GeekSpeak today. Skype.
Social software services.
Skype is not so private. So there's this wonderful article I read up on regarding how privacy is not so private in Skype. So a while ago, Microsoft bought Skype. And Skype, of course, is the telephony system. And it also used text messaging. And a company by the name of, it's H Online. They just go by H. But they're a security company. Has looked into a problem that emerged that they thought was a little strange. They were chatting amongst each other. And they passed each other, between the text message through Skype, they passed each other a URL. And this URL was a unique URL that was actually HTTPS and had some authentication information in the URL. So one person sent it to the next person through Skype. a couple hours later, they were looking through the logs and saw that that same URL that only existed in this message between them was visited by a machine in Redmond, which is where Microsoft is. So, and about 2 hours later. So they tested it again. Basically, this idea is that when I'm chatting with you through Skype, Ben, my assumption is that my communication with you is between you and me.
Yeah.
And if I send some secret information, I would assume that no one else gets it.
Yeah.
The URL,
and that URL being private, it's right. unique.
Right.
It's, yeah, the only people who can have it would be us.
So when the security company saw this, Hise Security saw this, they contacted Microsoft, and Microsoft referred, or Skype referred them to a part of their data protection private policy, which states, Skype may use automated scanning with instant messages and SMS to identify suspected spam and or identify URLs that have been previously flagged as spam, fraud, or phishing links. So here's the basic idea. You and I are chatting, but maybe I don't trust you very much. You send me a link, which is a link to a Twitter account to log in, but really it's a phishing attack. It's not really a Twitter account. Skype has this in their policy. They can scan, see if it looks bad, and then hide it,
decide
protecting
to hide
me.
It. Oh, wow.
So potentially it could be a good service, but...
They waited 2 hours, didn't they?
They waited 2 hours, which totally blows that idea out of the water, because by that time you already have my Twitter account, and you're spamming my Twitter account users and making bad things happen.
Ooh.
So this does not jive with it. Also, so other companies have approved, as awful seen this, this is very true, is happening. Skype sometimes will, when you pass a URL, will take that URL and visit the page. Now, the other thing they're doing for the spam aspect, well, maybe they're just checking to see if it's spam and they're building their spam database, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing they do when they check it, they don't actually ask for the content of the page. They only check for the headers of it. So they
so
wouldn't
they
even
don't
know
run the page.
If spam
they
was
just,
on the page.
Oh.
But also they are passing all the authentication information, all the query string information, which actually had a session state in it as well. And that was, you know, one user was passing their session state to somebody else so they could log into their account that way. It's kind of an interesting way to log in. And that's what Microsoft grabbed. The other part of this that hasn't been covered a lot in these stories is that when Microsoft was purchasing Skype, one of the things that happened is a patent about how to, even though the Skype communication can be point-to-point, how to actually put in, they have a patent on this, how to tap that process, basically listen into the audio of that call.
Make it faster, your computer would connect directly to my computer.
Normally, that's how it would work.
But they have some way
So there's a patent in place that Microsoft holds that says, as you and I have a point-to-point communication, if there's a way to interrupt that point-to-point and put a man in the middle to actually dissect the audio. And since Microsoft actually builds the Skype client, that might be happening all the time. We don't know what's happening.
Yeah, because we can't look at the Skype
source right.
code.
And that kind of brings up this whole other point about government backdoors and privacy, which I don't think we're going to get to on today's show. But I would like to in the future talk more about this. This is a very important concept in privacy and security. If you make backdoors like this, they can be taken advantage of. And there's no way to protect yourself from that advantage. So you see over and over in security spaces where some company decided to put a little thing that would help them, and later on somebody figured that out and then took advantage of the system to get private data. So Skype, not so personal, not so private. Keep that in mind. And though it's probably automated, no human being is doing it, there is still, you know, eavesdropping and listening. The other aspect of this is, Ben, if you and I wanted to have a Skype communication, use Skype services, but still talk privately, we could do that. We could build a little Apple script on our own machines and encrypt all the content, pass each other a key over the phone that would be, or some secret knowledge we have, and unencrypt it on both ends. You and I could get away with doing complete privacy through Skype. Mm-hmm. Most individuals can't.
Yeah.
But I would argue that it's silly to have systems in place that allow, that say, hey, you have personal communication, but really there's a backdoor in privacy, because the people that really want to hide the information will come up with ways to hide it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I see what you mean. Basically, the people who are innocent, who don't have anything to hide, won't go through to crazy means. And the only criminals who will be able to be caught using this method are the ones who don't do their homework and don't figure out that there is a way to do it securely.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that's weird. I have a weird feeling in my stomach.
I agree.
Creepy.
In a second, we're going to talk about, strangely, we're going to talk about Sears and Kmart, but also autism here on Geek Speak. So stay with us. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. And what is the Sears and Kmart story, sir?
Sears and Kmart. Yeah, you guys remember that?
I remember those companies.
It's like Yeah, I guess Sears is still around.
All I can think of is
Kmart still around?
Of course they are. Yeah.
I mean, I just don't see it.
All
anymore.
I think of Sears and Kmart is large department stores.
I think the 90s.
Yeah.
Kind of like Yahoo.
Because once Amazon came around, I don't go to stores.
Yeah. Like, who needs stores? Anyway, so basically the short of this story is that Sears Holdings, which is the company that takes care of Sears and Kmart and a number of other properties, they have 3,200 properties around that number, spanning 25 million square feet of space over the United States.
Properties in the physical sense, pieces of physical space. Yes.
That's weird. We're talking about the physical world on Geek Speak.
What are they doing with it?
And it's not space.
These are shopping centers, old stores that aren't working or new stores?
Some of them are still open, obviously, and some of them are closed. So those closed stores, what do they do with them? I mean, they own the property. They haven't been able to use that property to make a profit or break even in terms of making
it be a
retail
store. I'm going to go with roller rinks. I love roller rinks.
Roller rinks. There will be tons of roller rinks.
Indoor drive-ins. No? Okay.
I mean, the stores are
what
big
are they going to use with them?
You could drive cars in. So actually what they're thinking about doing is using all of that real estate for server farms.
Data centers.
Yeah, data centers.
Sure.
So you have all these data centers. The first project, the project is called Ubiquity. So the first Ubiquity project will be a Sears store. It's on the south end of Chicago. It's closed. It's right by the Chicago Skyway. And it's 127,000 square feet. So it's huge. And it's going to be closing at the end of June. And they're going to retrofit it. It's going to be a multi-tenant data center. So, you know, you can go and have a rack or a server in Sears, in a closed Sears store.
All right, cool.
It's kind of cool. And, of course, they have a lot of power capacity because they're a huge store like that. Cool. And then the other thing that they might want to do with this is wireless. 70% of the United States population lives within 10 miles of a Sears or a Kmart store.
Interesting.
So if they took all of their stores and they put
wireless antennas
on the top, that would be 70% of the U.S. population would be within 10 miles.
Comes
of
down again. Real, it's all about location, location, location.
It really is. Mm-hmm. Even in the digital space.
All right, Sears Corporation probably putting data centers and Wi-Fi near you within the next few years.
Maybe,
unless
we'll
of course Google just buys them. All right.
Or Yahoo.
They have billions of dollars.
I mean, 90s, right? No. I have to say, Sears, not so much the 90s, but Kmart feels like the 90s to me.
Dude,
is that just me?
Where do you live? You live in Berkeley or something? Where do you live?
I live near Sunnyvale.
Okay. I live in the San Lorenzo Valley, right? And to get to Geek Speak, sometimes I go through Scotts Valley. In Scotts Valley, Kmart, right there.
Oh, I guess I just don't drive by one.
Yeah, well, you're just not a local, man. But you do drive... over the hill to come to Geek Speak every week, and I appreciate that.
I drive further than you do, and I do not drive back fast to Kmart.
I'm Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak, and the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a world traveler and programmer and teacher. And now we're going to talk about autism. All right, so first off, the SAP, which is a large software company based in Germany, just released this announcement that they want to hire people that think differently. Reminds me of the Apple ad.
Yeah. Except the Apple ad is think different, which is, of course, grammatically incorrect.
But that is different by its own nature. they want to hire engineers diagnosed with autism. And they're actually teaming up with this group called Specialstreen, which translates. It's a Dutch company, and it translates to the specialists. And this company is a social innovative company where the majority of employees have a diagnosis on the autism spectrum. Employees work as business consultants on tasks such as software testing, programming, and data entry for the public and private sectors. Again, still quoting from specialstream.com, we harness the special characteristics and talents of people with autism and use them as a competitive advantage and as a means to help people with autism secure meaningful employment. Specialstream has operations in numerous locations around the world. So, I've been doing Geek Speak for a long time, and I interact with a lot of people where we talk a bit about the autism spectrum. This is a kind of common talk in the tech industry, and there's even like terms to you know, just not pay attention to social cues and then just go, well, you know, that's just who I am. I'm autistic. And there's this kind of blatantness about it, which is ridiculous. It can be a medically diagnosed condition, and Some people state that it's not, I'm going to get another quote on this, that people with Asperger's, so Asperger's is one of those, it's on the spectrum of autism. People with Asperger's syndromes, a form of autism, are often average or above average intelligence. And that's kind of a common theme we see with it. But some autistic individuals take exception to the characterization of the condition as a disorder and are not particularly keen to join the ranks of the so-called neuro norms. So this space becomes a little touchy because, of course, it can be considered, talking about differences in brain structures and such is kind of can be touchy for people. But what I want to say is that it looks like people are trying to, a large software company is actually taking advantage of potentially different skill sets involved in a different way a human brain might work. And that's kind of compelling. What do you think about this?
I don't feel like I know enough about these topics to really chime in, but I it does seem compelling and interesting. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, I interact with a lot of geeks and I get that people think different. I mean, to connect this back to the Apple campaign of Think Different, when interviewing Steve Wozniak for this show, hung out with him, and Woz is this really cool guy. Like, I had a great time with him. He's really energetic and excited about life. And, you know, because he created the first, like, real competitive personal computer, the Apple I, the Apple II. And he's
brilliant.
He's brilliant. And there's a Geek Speak episode I'll link to from today's show with Woz on it. But we talked a long time, and some of it got on the show and some of it didn't. And one of the things that he's really interested in is numbers. Like, he's fascinated by phone numbers and numbers in general. And his brain is not, I mean, I would say the way he thinks is different than the way everybody else thinks. Like, that's just
fundamentally
not everybody.
Different.
Yeah, there's a fundamental difference. And if you want to classify that with a name of autism or autism spectrum or Asperger's syndrome, you could. But at the same time, he's also amiable. And I mean, everybody's different, right? Like, to say that the one is a certain type and a certain and different, someone's different type is not a good way to think about it. But I have seen in my years of talking to geeks, it is common for it's common for a highly technical, mathematical type logic brain who gets into focusing on software, for example, or electronics, to also have some problems with social cues. That's not an uncommon side effect. I like a person that's really engaged in that math space and can ignore some social cue problems with that.
And you know what's also interesting is a software company can use people with those minds, but if you're going to a job interview, it's the social, the amiability, the social cues thing. That's really, really important in job interviews, right? So that can be kind of fuzzy. I mean, you basically, to get hired, you need these social abilities that you may not actually need on the job if you're crunching numbers and stuff.
Yeah.
So
SAP, the company, will, I'm quoting again from this article, motivate the ecosystem to follow its example, is their idea of they believe that they share a common belief that innovation comes from the edges, and only by employing people who think different and spark innovation will SAP be prepared to handle the challenges of the 21st century, blah, blah, blah. So this idea that we want to have people that think differently, that is a core concept of diversity in general. If you want to come up with really interesting solutions, you need to come up with people that think different ways, right? A good example of that is different cultural backgrounds, different languages. All of these infer a different outlook on the world. And we see that throughout. It's probably one of the reasons, my take is one of the reasons why the America's been so good at innovation in some sense, right? This idea that you pull a lot of people together. Those core beliefs, I think, that core concept of diversity comes from this. And so this is another example of a company going, we should try to focus on hiring people that think different, which I love. I think that's really cool. All right. A little bit of rant about that. Learn more about all the stuff we talk about on GeekSpeak, of course, by going to geekspeak.org. Okay, AT&T contracts.
Oh, I don't know. I can't pass up an opportunity to rail on AT&T for being evil.
The views expressed on GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KSPeak. Go ahead.
Yeah, definitely my views. But so it is my opinion and the opinion of the law that if a company like AT&T or Verizon or T-Mobile or any of these Sprint, if they want to change the price, then they need to allow you to dodge out of your contract and go somewhere else if you don't want to pay the upgraded price. Otherwise, of course, the companies could theoretically lock you into a two-year contract
and keep raising the rate.
Raise the rate tremendously the first month, and you wouldn't have any legal recourse. So, so AT&T imposed this fee, and it's only, and I put only in italics, right? It's only an extra 61 cents per month, but it's for everybody. And it makes me really uncomfortable. It's really the principle of the thing rather than... I don't have AT&T, but if I had AT&T...
You'd really be upset.
I wouldn't be upset about the 61 cents. I would be upset that this fee exists at all because it is not a change in the rate that I pay them.
Right.
That's not the way they
It's a tax.
Yeah, it's the carrier. It's a new... they call it a monthly administrative charge. And they claim, of course, other carriers have done the same, and I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
But it's just, I don't know. It just makes me want to talk about it on a radio show or something.
Because you have the voice.
It's really not only annoying, I just feels actually fundamentally wrong.
I just heard this, one of the podcasts I listened to had an underwriter that was a small telco that does non-contracts, all pay what you use ideas. And I thought, that's awesome. I got to find them again.
Yeah.
So if you have a cell phone carrier that you actually like, please tell us about it.
Let us know.
Because I don't know one that I like. No one likes their cell phone carrier. Now you can contact us by going to geekspeak.org and click on contact us. It's actually, if you just have an email address, it's geeks@geekspeak.org is our email address.
Yeah, there is also Public Knowledge, which is a watchdog. They also criticized the change, and the senior attorney with the advocacy group said, his quote was, imagine if McDonald's advertised hamburgers for 75 cents, but then required you to pay a $3 bun fee or something like that. You know, I mean, it's kind of a characterized example. It's more like
you get your food at the restaurant counter and they give you the food and you take a bite out of it and you've already paid for it. And they go, 24 cents, please.
24 cents for the next bite and every bite thereafter.
There you go.
Yeah. Also, it reminds me, I did have AT&T internet service a while back.
Mm-hmm.
I think 3 or 4 years ago. I don't know if this is still true, but I was talking with the person and they said, okay, it's going to be this much for the month, for the blah, 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 for the plan. And then it's also going to be this much as the fee. And then some other amount for other fees. And I'm like, what, some other amount? What does some other amount mean? And they're like, well, it's usually not that much, but it's
so confusing. We can't tell you about it.
Like, I don't want to buy internet. I don't want to buy anything from somebody who can't tell me how much it will cost, you know, because that administrative fee could be 30 cents or it could be $5.
Like, all right. Are you paying for Dropbox right now?
I am not. No, but
I am paying for Dropbox.
Oh, yeah.
Dropbox is like a syncing service. And actually, one of the other geeks works for another company. One of the other geeks that's normally on the show pretty regularly works for a company that does the same type of service.
Yeah.
And this idea basically is I produce a folder on my computer. And I make an account on some online service, and it grabs all the content on that folder, and it puts it on the online service. And then I go to another place, another machine, and I log in the same service, and it copies it all back down. And I can say, this folder should be shared with Ben, and this folder should be shared with Miles, and this folder I want to be public. And
synchronizing.
All of this stuff happens such that if Ben and I share files together and we edit them, they'll actually update each other.
Automatically.
Kind of. Yeah. Depending on the type of file. And anyway. Yeah.
Well,
some
it's Dropbox, everything is.
But if you're editing and you have a conflict, what happens? Also, if I share a file with you and you edit it, can I get back my changes? What if you delete it? Does it delete from my account? There's all these confusions.
This is why syncing is so difficult.
It's hard.
That's why Evernote and Dropbox.
Okay.
And
but the other point of this is that all these companies that do this thing have a central server that has your information on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is how private and all that. And we cover these topics every once in a while. But wouldn't it be cool if you and I could just launch this service together and not have anybody else in between? And that is the concept behind BitTorrent Sync, which was when it was in beta, I covered it on GeekSpeak months ago. I signed up for the beta program. I got it. I never tried it. Now it is available. You can download BitTorrent Sync. So Ben, this week you and I are going to do some playing with BitTorrent Sync. BitTorrent has has some undertones from most people that that illegal things happen in BitTorrent.
People think of it as software piracy and
but
stuff.
But all that BitTorrent really is a protocol to have personal sharing happen. And it's also distributed sharing. So there's some really cool concepts about BitTorrent, but the basic protocol is such that you can make ad hoc networks of sharing people that have no centralization. So it's completely democratic data sharing. And they've done that. Normally, I would produce a file, a folder. I'd put it up in the cloud. I'd do a whole bunch of encoding and stuff, and I'd make it available from my machine. And then I'd pass this kind of link to other people. They would look at it, start downloading it. As they downloaded, they'd start sharing too. And so the larger the network is, the faster the download happens. It's really cool. And this, we've talked about this for years on GeekSpeak. What the BitTorrent group, BitTorrent Labs, has produced is this thing called BitTorrent Sync, which basically is the same concept that we share URLs together and we can share files, but the syncing protocol actually is integrated into it as well. So if I have a folder and I've got six files in it, and then I share a link, Ben slowly will download the files. If he adds a folder to there, it'll get add back to me, and you basically get complete synchronization between data. And there's no central intermediary person. There's no user accounts. There's no passwords. This is all done by secret keys being passed around each other by any means you want. And it's awesome. And we're going to use it this week, Ben, and talk about it next week on GeekSpeak.
I love the idea. I especially love the technology behind BitTorrent. It's
fantastic.
So cool.
Fantastic. Well, this has been one more hour of your life wasted away.
Wasted. So self-deprecating.
Listening to GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak on 88.9 KOSP or KOSP.org. You can learn more about the show at GeekSpeak.org. And you can contact us with questions and comments about technology and read more about the news stories we covered today on the program. My name is Lyle Troxell. This is the 25th of May's show. Today with me was Ben Jaffe. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. We'll be back next week here on KOSP. Thanks, Ben, for being here.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.